My name is Dario Hasenstab. I'm here with Balder Hagerts, and we're back with the Western Bubble podcast. Today, we're talking about war because we're not talking about it enough. Hi, Balder. Why are we speaking about this topic today? Why are we talking about war?
Hi, Dario. We're not talking about war in a broad sense, but more the fear of war today. A couple of months ago, I sent you a link to an article that outraged me, that made me upset, and I get easily upset with these kinds of things, I must admit, that the Dutch population, about half of the Dutch population, is afraid that in the near future, war might break out in the Netherlands, that someone will attack the Netherlands and that the Netherlands will find itself in a war situation. And that is such an insane take. There is absolutely no serious scenario in which Western European or North American countries will be attacked by the outside. They might attack. They have been doing that in the past. But there is no serious analysis or any kind of serious thinking that will lead to the conclusion that Russia or China or anyone else will attack the West in the near future, or even in the medium or long-term future. And the fact that people are terrified of this, that people are afraid of this, is both a show of broad ignorance, but also a very scary observation, because that could actually lead to some kind of self-fulfilling prophecy where the fear of war makes us warmongers. And so that's why we're talking about that today.
And what are the facts?
Western leaders and populations are increasingly fearful of warfare on their doorsteps as military budgets continue to rise annually, with a 6.8% global increase in defense spending last year. Poland alone saw over 75% increase to its defense spending in 2023. Populations are fearful of global war starting, with over 60% of Americans believing that there's at least a somewhat likely chance to have a global war in the next 10 years. These fears are only encouraged by Western leaders, both inside politics and outside. Joe Biden said in June that Russia will not stop at Ukraine and all of Europe will be threatened, while JP Morgan Chase CEO said in an annual investor letter that various global factors may very well be creating risks that could eclipse into anything since World War II.
What is the bubble?
So, Balder, you are, as we've discussed multiple times with our listeners, you're ancient, right? You have lived through the Cold War, or at least some years of it. Let's, as always, look a little bit into the past at the beginning. When you grew up, how scared were you of war reaching Amsterdam tomorrow?
Well, I guess the good thing is that when I grew up, there was no social media to make me even more scared. It was... So I was 11 when the Berlin Wall fell, and I was very keenly aware of the threat of nuclear weapons. We grew up, even as a 6, 7, 8-year-old boy, we knew that the atomic bomb, as we would call it in those days, could drop on our countries. That was a serious, serious issue. And even though my childhood was towards the end and we were getting more optimistic because of Gorbachev's rise and Perestroika, Glasnost, there was a real, real understanding that if we weren't careful, we could really destroy this planet by having these two super blocks powers going at it. That was a real thing. And even though no serious analysis existed that the Soviet Union would attack the United States directly, or the United States would attack Soviet Union, so things can go wrong, and you know, some people might press the wrong button, and then all of a sudden you find yourself into World War III. That was a serious threat.
I mean, I recall this as well from conversations with my parents and grandparents, that there was always this kind of this underlying fear that, hey, if something were to happen, it's definitely going to happen here in Europe, and Germany would be a very easy and quick target simply because of the divide. I mean, then there was also a German pragmatic approach to, I mean, at least then it's over, right? And then the others can continue fighting while everything here is a nuclear wasteland. But you said that anything could be over with the push of a button. And I think that's very interesting because for me, one of my heroes, at least during the first few years of my studies, because it also happened to be the years when the man died, was Stanislav Petrov, right? A Russian army officer who was responsible basically for sitting in front of the machines, detecting any nuclear basically movement on the American side, and who actually was in the situation where suddenly the Russian computer said, hey, there is a US strike imminent, like rockets have been launched, and he needed to decide whether to inform his superiors and actually say, hello, Washington just launched nuclear missiles at us, or is there maybe a chance of a technical glitch, which it was ultimately. And so there's always this talk of him actually having saved the world from a nuclear holocaust.
Yeah, and that's exactly the scary scenario that existed in those days. I think that we owe him a lot. It's not clear that if he had pressed the famous or infamous red button, if that would have straight away have led to nuclear warfare, because there were some mechanisms in place before the Soviet Union would have reached that stage. But people who just think rationally and aren't called up by fear, right? And aren't called up in this idea of there's this evil enemy about to destroy us. He essentially evaluated the situation rationally and said, what is the likelihood here? The likely scenario is that the computer is malfunctioning. In the 1970s, that was not a crazy idea at all. And so as a result, there was a de-escalation of something that could have very easily escalated in that scenario where people are already terrified of each other, where people are actually every day waking up believing that there's an enemy ready to destroy them.
I mean, just put the average person in Western societies today into that scenario, right? So just imagine you're sitting in a room and suddenly the computer is showing that Putin has launched nuclear missiles at Kiev, Berlin, Paris, Amsterdam, Madrid, Washington. I mean, what is the average person today going to think in their analysis? I mean, obviously, they don't have the same training as Petrov. But, I mean, I read it on the fact sheet, 60% of Americans believe that there's a likely scenario of World War III happening in the next 10 years.
Well, no, that's exactly right. And especially because of the way we have, if you like, demonized Russia and China. And before this, it's not that I'm approving of Russian foreign policy, but it's not a bunch of evil orcish hordes who are about to destroy the earth. And yet that is how we talk about Russia. That's how we think about Russia. And so within that setting, if you are already in that bubble of we are going to find ourselves fighting the Russians, then the moment that your computer screen says that, then it sort of fits the pattern. And you're very likely to say, oh, this is the moment that I for years have been preparing for. And you would be completely wrong, because of course there's absolutely no scenario in which Russia would voluntarily attack the West. It's just not going to happen, people.
And right, kind of to add on the situation with Petrov, because obviously there was a movie made about him. There's a lot of literature on him now, and I definitely encourage all of our listeners to look into that man, because I don't know, I see him a little bit as a hero. I really like this idea of someone actually having a clear mind, right? An analyst doing what they're supposed to do. But then there was another analyst who basically kind of highlighted the importance of him doing his job. Oleg Kalugin, a former KGB chief of foreign counterintelligence, who said that the danger was in Soviet leadership thinking, right? That, oh, the Americans may attack, so we better attack first. So it wasn't, right, the problem within the general population, within the general military, but the fear of basically your own leadership thinking that, oh no, what happens if Joe Biden is kind of confronted with data that Russia has launched an attack? Will he stay cool and say, oh, maybe ChatGPT had server problems? Or is the situation that Putin's actually attacking?
Yes, if your mindset is that, if you are a hammer, every problem in the world looks like a nail. If you are convinced that you are fighting a destructive existential enemy, then everything that supposed enemy does is going to be an existential threat. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. And with the Soviet leadership believing that they were going to be attacked, then it absolutely makes sense that they're on edge. And the moment there are any indications that the Americans are moving, you start pressing buttons because you want to be the first. That is exactly the danger of this kind of warmongering, this kind of jingoism. We know that analysis from the Cold War. We know also what a relief it was that we didn't have to worry about that afterwards anymore.
And that relief materialized very quickly, or didn't materialize, basically, in a huge decrease in military spending, right? So the Cold War is over. The risk scenarios are gone. We no longer have to fear that there might be nuclear holocaust tomorrow. So why would we continue spending on the military if the world is on a path to peace, right? The end of history. We've talked about this multiple times. We've won it. There's no more threats.
Right. And that is the famous peace dividend, as it was called. And the 1990s, people in the 1990s were keenly aware of this, that we could reduce military budgets depending on the country, but they easily went down from, let's say, 4% of GDP to 1% or 1.5% of GDP. That freed up an awful lot of economic financial resources to invest in infrastructure, technology, education, the things that you want to invest in if you care about your society. Because let's face it, building tanks is not a particularly productive way to spend your money, because those tanks don't do anything productive, especially not if there is no enemy around, right? There was a real peace dividend that was one of various factors. Another factor was technology that led to an enormous economic boom in the 1990s, a very positive attitude towards the 21st century. The internet was coming, the whole world was going to come closer, we were all going to hold hands or maybe meet on social media and sing Kumbaya together. And it seemed that the world was just moving towards a better place. We were optimistic, and that optimism also led to a reduction in real threats. Because if you look at the world in more positive terms, if you think, you know what, those Russians aren't that bad. They were, you know, in the past they were suffering from authoritarianism, but now they are becoming one of us and everything is going to be happier, then whenever the Russian foreign policy did something, it wouldn't be straight away interpreted as something deeply destructive. And instead, there would be communication, there would be dialogue, there would be a summit. Let's talk about what just happened. Can we have a conversation rather than pointing missiles at each other? The world became a safer place because we believed that the world was a safer place. That was a positive, reinforcing, virtuous circle, if you like.
Mm-hmm. And then somewhere in the last 20, 30 years, the West took a wrong turn, right? I mean, we've talked about this general decay of the West. And those attitudes have changed. We are no longer as looking as friendly and benevolent onto the world as may have been the case in the 1990s and early 2000s is already a stretch.
Yeah, so there are a number of issues going on. So the obvious first historic moment to look at is 9/11, because all of a sudden that happiness, that feeling of being safe that existed in the West. I mean, there were lots of populations in the world that weren't safe yet because they were still suffering from war, the Rwandan genocides, the Balkans, but Western Europe and North America felt safe until 9/11 happened, and that did something with our mentality. All of a sudden, we felt threatened again, and we started doing really weird things that went against our own interest, right? We started militarizing the world again. We started changing our own democratic structures, weakening our institutions, because we had to fight anonymous terrorists that were hiding among us and about to explode bombs in Times Square or Piccadilly or wherever. So we became fearful, and that fear led to destruction automatically. You know, and that is not a difficult psychological phenomenon to understand. The moment that you believe that there's a terrorist around every corner is the moment that you start carrying a weapon, and by you carrying a weapon, you make the world around you less safe and people are going to be a threat to you. It becomes a vicious circle. It becomes negative. Now, that was the first historical sort of downturn. And since then, we've sunk deeper into the swamp, if you like. We've sunk deeper into darkness. We are starting to feel less secure of who we are, about our own societies. The liberal democracies are suffering. Russia has once again turned to authoritarianism, and we feel fearful of that. China is becoming more and more authoritarian, and we feel fearful about that. So we are becoming very scared creatures. And that is dangerous for the rest of the world. And it's dangerous for ourselves.
And it's wrong, right? I mean, we don't have to be scared. We don't have to be scared of the war. Because there is no threat of war within Europe or the United States. I mean, there is no imperialist Japan waiting to basically conquer the United States from the Pacific. Russia is currently invading Ukraine, but there is no scenario in which Russia is now continuing to Warsaw or to Berlin or to Amsterdam. There is no real threat in that sense.
Yeah, so, I mean, it is just an observed fact that we are more fearful. The question is, where does that fear rationally come from? How can we explain that fear? Because exactly as you said, there is no scenario at all in which Russia would invade Western Europe. It's just not going to happen. Even so, the other day I had a conversation with a good Polish friend, very good friend, intelligent and very knowledgeable. And even he seemed to be a little bit nervous about this. Like, hey, look at what happened with Ukraine. Now they're going to go we have to be careful that they're not going to go into our country next. Russia is not going to send tanks to Warsaw. I mean, they did in the past, and I understand it from a Polish perspective, from a Polish subconscious. There, you know, this still triggers trauma from the past, so that is very understandable. But a rational analysis in 2024 is not that Russia would do that. Not that it's unlikely. I'm saying it's impossible that Russia would invade voluntarily, that they would make the first move to invade Western Europe or the European Union or NATO or anything like that. So it's not that I'm underestimating saying, well, it's only 10% chance. No, it's near zero, that chance, right? And the reason for that is that the Russians know that that would be the end of Russia. The European Union alone, even without the United States, without NATO, would be perfectly capable of defeating Russia. Everyone knows that. Putin knows that. The Kremlin knows that. Europe doesn't need to up its defense budget in order to be able to do that. There is nothing to be gained by the Russians for doing that. What we might be afraid of, or should be maybe a little bit concerned about, is something going wrong with nuclear weapons. Someone accidentally sending up a nuclear weapon. And thanks, Petrov, for rationally analyzing situation in the 70s. But it could happen one day that some installation malfunctions, ChatGPT messes up the computer systems, and a nuclear missile heads for Berlin. But that wouldn't be Russia voluntarily attacking Germany. That would be a computer glitch.
Yes, I mean, well, it's like now I'm thinking about me sitting in Berlin and a computer glitch.
Oh, I'm sorry, I should have used another city to make you less worried.
Exactly.
Rome. Let's focus on Rome.
Rome. Rome took good food. I mean, a different city. Okay. On the other hand, right, so there's no real threat by any country invading Europe or invading the United States. But on the other hand, the West is very much a threat to some other parts of the world, right? We've seen this in the past. I mean, there's countless countries that we could now name. I mean, just to name a few, right? Libya, Syria, Afghanistan, Iraq, that all have had a very recent history of the West full-on invading those countries.
Yeah, and this is still, I sometimes look at the world and I'm astounded by the magic with which the enormous delusion under which Western populations live their lives. So we are becoming fearful of Russia or China. We are fearful of them. And yet we are the ones who have started wars. We are the ones who have military bases all across the planet. We are the ones who are sending our navies towards the Taiwan Strait. We are the ones who are the aggressors. And yet we tell ourselves, because we are somehow liberal democracies, that we do it for the right purposes, and those other countries are out to get us and out for destruction. Completely ignoring the fact that China has not invaded any other country in the past 40 years. China's military defense capabilities are all focused on the South China Sea and Taiwan. There is no Chinese military capability to even attack anything further than that, let alone Europe or North America. essentially, we are amazing at telling ourselves a big lie, namely that the rest of the world is a threat to us, rather than looking at reality, asking ourselves who are the ones who have attacked other countries, who are the ones who have invaded, destroyed civilians, civilian houses, populations. The answer to that, realistically, factually, is us. We are the threat. And we're becoming a greater threat now that we are fearful, right? It was bad enough when we weren't very scared. But now that we are really scared, we are actually becoming a much scarier monster for the rest of the world.
Exactly. So we are societies that are less and less kind to each other, but also to outsiders. I mean, we talked in one of the previous episodes about the results of the European elections, right? Where we also now see in election results that people are just fearful and therefore less kind to outsiders, right? I mean, this is obviously a big issue with migration, but also here with war, right? Is you're really insecure about things that are going on the inside. Something is off. We don't really know exactly what. So we start externalizing problems and we start projecting our fears towards the outsiders. So these are either the evil immigrants, the evil Chinese who are, I don't know, trying to do something with 5G and technology and so on, or the evil Russians who will invade us tomorrow.
Yeah, and the foundation of that is simply that we are uncomfortable, like you said, that we are now living in a society that is insecure. I think there's an interesting line of thinking that leads to the conclusion that we no longer have a purpose. And if you no longer have a purpose, like that pensioner who's just sitting on his wealth in his house and has nothing else to do in life, just enjoy the wealth, doesn't need to build up a career anymore and just becomes fearful of those youths stealing his money, that kind of thing. We in the West no longer seem to have a purpose. We're no longer moving towards something. Unlike, for example, China, which is still very much trying to make something happen. Unlike India, unlike Sub-Saharan Africa. And so by having a lack of purpose and just leading our lives based on the hard work of previous generations, we are becoming uncomfortable, we're becoming a little bit unsettled, and we become scared. And therefore, then we project it on the outsider. But in reality, it's a problem inside of our own population, inside of our own society. It's a problem that our leaders no longer have a discourse of what we want to accomplish, what we want to achieve. It's all about maintaining what we've got rather than creating something new. And the moment that happens, societies become inward-looking, societies become aggressive towards themselves, right? People are less kind towards themselves. That is a fundamental weakness of liberal democracy, because if you are a liberal democratic society, that liberal democracy doesn't as much depend on the specific laws. They are important, but it depends much more on people respecting each other and people saying hello to each other in the street and people not believing that their neighbor or the person in the street or in the shop is a threat, but saying, hey, we're in this together. We're a liberal democracy. Let's work together. And yet our societies are going in the opposite direction. We're no longer really looking at working together. We're looking at enemies. We're looking at other political parties that are supposedly evil. We're looking at other classes, liberals versus conservatives, rich versus poor, outsider versus insider. And then the automatic consequence of that, the most natural evolution of that, is that beyond that level of internal discomfort, we start looking at outsiders as the ultimate boss threat, right? The ultimate enemy to be defeated. And whether that is immigrants or whether that is Vladimir Putin or Xi Jinping, it's people who are not us that are out to get us.
What's the international relations context?
Well, let's look at those potential threats that we might project our fears onto, or maybe even our own behavior, right? Believing that there is the typical behavior that you will use on the global stage, right? That's invading a country once in a while, or attacking, right, with airstrikes and so on, a regime change and so on and so forth. So let's look at some of those evildoers on the international stage. I mean, we've already mentioned some of them. Right. I mean, the first one is obviously Russia. And I mean, I am personally am never mad at the average Joe or the average Josephine fearing that there's war happening, right? I mean, so this is never their fault because there's media, there's politicians and so on. And then there's also the very real fact that Russia has invaded Ukraine. So there is a scenario in which you can believe, oh, right after they're done with Ukraine and Joe Biden tells me that after Kiev has fallen, Russia will move into Poland, right? And that's one of those actors that we now look at and we are fearful of.
Yeah, I would add to what you said about the average Joe, Josephine, that it's not, obviously it's not useful to morally judge people, even morally judge the media or politicians. I think that kind of moral judgments clouds our ability to analyze, and we should try to stay away from that. I do think we need to give accountability or hold populations, the average Joe and Josephine, responsible in the sense of analysis, right? In an analytical sense, voters can be very destructive in their behavior. The average person in the street can either be productive in the way that they influence society, or they can have a negative consequence, just analytically. But yeah, it is completely clear that there are large scale dynamics, long-term dynamics that are making people afraid. And that is a very complex mix of media, of politics, and just like I said, the average Joe and Josephine feeling uncomfortable with their lives and being more susceptible to being afraid, right? Being more susceptible to media stories. And then the media plays with that because the media likes it when people click on the links. If in the 1990s you had done that fear-mongering, people wouldn't have really cared because it wasn't relevant to their mindset. But now it's relevant to their mindset because apparently talking about how scary Vladimir Putin or Xi Jinping is gives us some kind of fake answer to our anxiety. And rather than having to then delve into the real reasons for our anxiety, we can project it onto the outsider.
Well, and all the times there's articles out there, basically, are we heading towards World War III? And then you have some security analyst or some form of, right, I mean, even former government analyst basically saying that, oh, let's look at Iran after they attacked Israel a few weeks ago. Sending missiles or drones to Israel. I think none of them actually reached Israel in the end. Saying that, oh, Tehran is no longer hiding behind its proxies, right? This is a new phase of escalation. I mean, if you read that, again, I mean, yes, the average Joe Josephine should do their own analysis, but I don't know, if a former Israeli government official and analyst tells me that, oh, this is a new phase and Iran is no longer hiding behind its proxies, I don't know whether I'm able to do that analysis without necessarily holding an international relations degree.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's fair. It depends a little bit on how serious you take the rational mind of the average voter or the average person in the street, right? I would like to think that we as human beings are capable of thinking for themselves. But yeah, it's absolutely true that if you hear something like that and you don't think further about it because you've got other things to do in your life, you're not an IR expert and you just read your newspaper once a day or listen to social media, then that could be a very scary thing to hear, and then your worst demons get activated in your mind, and that will lead to you liking politicians who say, I will protect you against this threat. So you start believing in a non-existent threat. Now you want your politicians to actually protect you against that non-existing threat. By that, your society becomes a threat to the other, and now all of a sudden the other actually has become a threat. And that's exactly the danger that we're running into when we analyze Russia or China or Iran.
I mean, for the last years or maybe even decades, right, we've had different nuclear weapons experts telling us that, oh, Iran is only a few days away from the bomb here, right? Iran will turn to another avenue to up the stakes with the US, its nuclear program. I mean, if you hear that all the time, that's fear-mongering.
It's amazing. And I often tell my students at university this as well. As long as I am alive, and in the 1980s, I wasn't reading reports yet, but as long as I am alive, there have been reports that Iran is just this close, like a few weeks, a few months, maybe a couple of years away from becoming a major nuclear threat. Mossad reports, CIA reports, European intelligence agencies claiming in the 80s, in the 90s, in the early 2000s, in the past decade, and now in 2024, over and over again, Iran is this close to developing nuclear weapons. At some point, surely this becomes a matter of the boy crying wolf, right? After two or three of those reports not materializing, we should scratch our head and ask ourselves, hey, maybe something else is happening here. Now, the problem with all of this, with this rhetoric, is that at some point we're actually incentivizing Iran to develop nuclear weapons, because they understand that if we believe that they're about to have nuclear weapons, that we're likely to attack them. And so maybe the way for them to defend themselves against being attacked is having nuclear weapons. This is the craziness of the dynamics that we are voluntarily in the West creating. This is not Iran creating it. This is not China creating it. This is us creating our own demons, willfully so. And that is something that we need to break. That is a pattern that can't continue. Because yes, Russia invaded Ukraine. Russia is an existential threat to Ukraine, by definition, by what they're doing, obvious. They started a voluntary war that was a very ugly and destructive thing to do and should be absolutely condemned. But them invading Ukraine in no way means that they would actually even ponder, even contemplate attacking NATO countries or Western Europe or anything like that. And China hasn't even shown anything to be attacking. So how are we talking about China? What evidence do we have that they're even in any way a military threat to us?
Well, I mean, you tell me, or the UK Defense Secretary Grant Shapps basically tell me, because he a few weeks ago warned that the world could be engulfed by wars involving China, Russia, North Korea, and Iran in the next 5 years, and said that we're moving from a post-war to a pre-war world. I don't know, Paula, that's the Minister of Defense talking.
Again, I'm being a broken record here, but the words self-fulfilling and prophecy come to mind. I mean, this is... I'll tell you this much. If in the next 5 years or 10 years there is some kind of military conflict between us and China or us and Iran, I know for sure who started it. And it's... Here's a hint. It's not China and it's not Iran. There is just no serious scenario in which... Why would China ever want a military conflict with the West? You can speculate about what they will do with Taiwan, and you can speculate if the West decides to be involved in that, but that would be a choice by the West. Now, again, just like the Iran nuclear weapons, for decades now we've heard that China is just about to invade Taiwan because military exercises have been happening for the past 20 years over Taiwan airspace, and the West always sees that as an indication like, oh, it's just about to happen, but that is about Taiwan. Just like... Ukraine is about Ukraine. The West can choose to be involved or not involved, and you can have an argument about whether they should or not. I don't think they should, but you could have a conversation about that, a serious, rational conversation. But a World War III scenario, as you just quoted, a situation where military conflict exists between the West and those other four countries that you mentioned, would only occur if the West chooses that, not from Berlin or Moscow.
Another element that I quickly want to discuss in this category, right? So far we've talked about, are we engulfed by wars or not, right? Who are the evil doers out there, right? Why is North Korea attacking us tomorrow, or Iran, or Russia, or China? Another element here that I think comes from, well, actually, let's analyze where it comes from, because I'm not sure whether I have a conclusive thought on this yet, is that element of different weapon systems being developed. I remember very well 2 years ago, there was this big talk about, oh, Russia has developed hypersonic missiles and the West has no defense mechanisms against them because those missiles are way too fast for our conventional defense missiles. So if Russia wanted to basically attach a nuclear warhead to this, they could be in Washington in 2 minutes, all right? And China is working on this technology too, and the West is lacking behind years, decades in research and development. I mean, that's another element that don't know, it's worrisome to me. I don't know if I'm reading that Russia has these missiles and I'm your average Josephine or Joe, right? Then I feel like there is a reason for me to be worried, particularly if I'm not sitting in the 1990s thinking that world war is just over.
Yeah, and so the analysis there is complex, right? So on the one hand, you've got this this need of, for example, Russia to make themselves sound scary, right? So Russia also, Putin very much built up the hype around these hypersonic weapons. And Western media very happily jumped on that, and Western politicians. Newsflash, Russia doesn't need hypersonic weapons to destroy New York. If Russia tomorrow wants to destroy New York with nuclear weapons, they can. That there is very little that the United States has to guarantee that New York won't be destroyed. But you know why Russia won't do that? Because they know that the next day, Russia will be destroyed. And that's exactly the issue here. Russia doesn't need any special weapons to be destructive. They can destroy cities. They could destroy Kiev. Why don't they want to destroy Kiev? Because they want to win the war in Ukraine by conquering Ukraine and saying, we've liberated Ukraine from evil fascist Zelensky, or whatever narrative the Kremlin will push. There is no need for those special super hypersonic weapons, but it feeds into our narrative, because right now a serious analysis is that Russia is not a military threat to the West. If we somehow can convince ourselves that Russia has some super special weapons that will nullify all our military capabilities, then all of a sudden that will be helpful in our fear system, right? Our system of fear and sense of threat and the need to defend ourselves against such a threat.
When talking about these hypersonic missiles, because you mentioned Ukraine, right? I mean, Russia used those hypersonic missiles in Ukraine, and basically the outcome was that they targeted energy systems and then destroyed these energy systems. At the same time, Russia has been targeting these energy systems for 2 years now and has successfully destroyed many of them. So I'm not sure where that big, I don't know where that big advantage is coming, is then coming into play. But it's, again, it's another level to this conversation of we're fearful. I mean, there are threats out there. There's hypersonic missiles that could land in my garden at any second.
And it's very interesting that when Russia hyped this up themselves, it was at a time that the war in Ukraine was going quite badly for them, right? They had been embarrassed. They had made a complete mess of it. Ukrainians fought back very hard. And they were kind of in need of positive news. It reminds me a little bit of those super weapons that the Nazis were supposed to develop in 1944, and, you know, to turn the world around. That's kind of what Putin did here. And it's just shocking how Western media and Western politicians sort of let this happen, knowing from any serious military analyst that the concerns about these weapons were completely overestimated and not serious. There were no serious changes in the battle scenarios in the military analysis because of these weapons. It is really important to remember that this nuclear destruction of cities can take place at any time. We've known that for 70 years now. That's since the Second World War, since the start of the Cold War, we know that we as humanity have the capability of destroying ourselves. But it's also important to remember that those nuclear weapons are very unlikely to be used in any way unless a state is under existential threat. So unless a conventional warfare turns into some kind of disaster scenario, if, let's say, Ukraine were to defeat the Russian military and then start marching towards Moscow, and supported by NATO, the West starts invading Russia, then at some point, in a moment of panic, Russian military might start pressing nuclear buttons, but otherwise it will not happen. And the second fundamental thing to remember here is that the West has multiple factors of military strength over Russia. Take a couple of countries from the West and they will be able to defeat Russia in a full-scale conventional war. So all of this fear-mongering, all of this hype about we need to increase our military budget. Let's take away money from schools, let's take away money from hospitals, and let's spend it on tanks, is completely wasted money simply based on a population that is fearful without knowing why it's fearful, without understanding the complexity of the world, and finding comfort in some kind of fake defense that is completely unnecessary.
And can you explain to our listeners what is the problem?
So talking about this incredibly fear-driven society, and you already mentioned a few of the things that are damaging here, right? I mean, money is being spent on the military more, right? I mean, more militarization leads to also that spiral, because now other countries feel the need that they need to further militarize. We're talking about a pre-World War One scenario here, right? Where then everyone is sitting on their big guns. And I've said in the past that if you have big guns, you want to use those big guns. Money is also not... I mean, by spending money on the military, it's also not being spent on other things that we've at length analyzed in other episodes, right? That there's a lot of things within the West that should be, we should be spending money on: infrastructure, education, the training of people, and so like reducing inequalities and so on and so forth. Those are like this attitude, like this fear-driven attitude and this worry about war is very damaging to the West in multiple levels. I mean, ultimately a symptom of what we've been discussing for the past 2 years now.
Yeah, and I think it's very useful that you quoted Kalugin before. Let me quote him again just to remind the listeners, because it was not 20 minutes ago that you quoted him. The quote is, "The danger was in the Soviet leadership thinking." This is within the Cold War setting. "The Americans may attack, so we better attack first," end quote. So this is exactly the damage that... by us creating those threats in our minds, we are creating those threats. On top of that, we are not dealing with the actual problems that our society faces, because our societies do face problems. The fact that we don't have this sense of purpose, that we're not walking towards an optimistic future, but we're trying to protect what we have and we're not doing a very good job at it, means that we should invest resources, thinking, finances into our education, into our political system, strengthen our institutions. But instead, rather than doing that, we're buying more tanks and we're building more missiles, even though we already have more than anyone else in the world. And so that means that we are walking towards dystopia. We are doing everything we can to create a worse future for ourselves and for our children, rather than working towards a utopia, trying to envision a world where we cooperate with each other. And I know that this sounds very soft and cheesy, and you know, people say, "Oh, bother, what kind of naive idealism are you spouting here?" No, it's not so much about that. I think that in 10 years' time, the world could be a happy, peaceful place. That's not what it's about. It's about, what are you trying to accomplish? What is your definition of success in the long term? My definition of success, and I would argue for almost everyone, is I would love to see a world where we don't have to be afraid of each other and where we can cooperate. That's not going to be something that may be achievable, but it's certainly something we should work towards. And instead, we're doing the opposite. We seem to be building a world where in the end we will be fighting each other. We will be fighting Russia. We will be fighting China. We've sort of decided that that's going to happen. And so we're going to do everything available to us to be the winner of such a fight. Well, I can tell you there's never going to be a winner in a fight between the West and China, or a fight between the West and Russia. Everyone's going to be losers.
And what now?
Well, so this segment now about talking about the future is going to be depressingly short, because there's no perspective of this changing anytime soon, which does kind of give me the chance to advertise basically the middle of June, right? The middle of July, sorry, when we will be recording our episodes on, hey, what are some solutions in the West, right? When we will basically be solving all the problems in the West. Last time you tried to intervene here and basically manage expectations here, but I'm going to say that In a month's time, we will be publishing wonderful episodes kind of outlining how to save the West. Because if Liz Truss can do it, we can do it for sure too.
Yeah, this is such a rookie mistake, Dario, because I would hope that they are going to be happy, useful episodes that our listeners will listen to, will like and enjoy. But right now you've hyped it so much that it can only become a disappointment. But sure, you know... I look forward to people sending us messages saying, hey, I had high hopes, but I'm very disappointed because you don't provide solutions to how to get to utopia.
Well, I think it's better that we disappoint the people than basically the real world disappoints people, because, I mean, kind of to wrap up this episode, I mean, I don't see a scenario in which the West doesn't continue down this path, right, where, I mean, the militarization will be decreased, where the fear of war will go away unless war actually happens and everyone can say, oh, we were right.
Yeah, we will continue on this path as long as we are unwilling to deal with the underlying issues that our society is actually facing, the lack of purpose, the lack of positivity, the lack of understanding of who we are and who we want to be, the lack of, if you like, dreaming. It kind of is like that guy who gets into fights with everyone, and he will keep on fighting with everyone until he goes to therapy, right? So until the West goes into therapy, until the West starts recognizing their own psychological and sociological patterns, Western militarization will absolutely continue, and the rest of the world, understandably, will be scared of us and will try to protect itself against us, because we are the monsters who have been bombing places, not China, Russia in Ukraine, but not elsewhere, well, in Georgia, but not elsewhere. It is very, very important to realize that we need to go in therapy. And when that happens, maybe we can change our tune, start a new chapter.
This seems like a great moment to end today's conversation on the fear of war in the West. If you have any comments, questions, or you heard a mistake that we've made throughout the episode, please make sure to send us an email to thewesternbubble@gmail.com, and we will try to incorporate them in our following episodes. Thank you very much to the listeners for joining us today. Make sure to join us again next week when we burst the Western bubble. That is it from my side. Balder, which closing quote did you pick for us today?
Given that we can't praise Stanislav Petrov enough for saving the world potentially from nuclear holocaust in the 80s, it is going to be a quote from him, and it emphasizes the fact that he focused on what he was good at, what he was supposed to do. He wasn't caught up in political narratives. He wasn't caught up in the fear-mongering that existed during the Cold War, thinking that the United States was just some kind of evil entity about to destroy his homeland. No, instead, he just focused on understanding the computer, understanding what information he got from the systems. And by doing so, he contributed tremendously to the well-being of future generations, obviously. And the quote goes, "At first, when people started telling me that these TV reports had started calling me a hero, I was surprised. I never thought of myself as one. After all, I was literally just doing my job."